So Chris, you've been at Procore for just over a year and a half now. You're out of our Austin office, which is arguably one of the nicest yeah. offices that we have. Your LinkedIn says that you're a customer support technician. I if you held a gun to my head and forced me to tell the world what that meant, I would die. I have
it's
no
a
idea.
Very fancy way of saying customer support rep.
Okay.
That's what it is. Honestly, it's a situation where I think when I started working at Procore, people use technician as opposed to customer support rep, and it just kind of stuck. So it's one of those things where you put on your LinkedIn, you put on your resume because it looks really, really good. But I think essentially they are synonymous. I don't want to belittle the role itself, and I can kind of go into that a little bit more. I think there is a little bit more of a technical aspect to it, which is why we can use the moniker of technician, but I like to think that it's a customer support role.
Okay. And nice. So what does that mean? Yeah. Like how are you supporting the customers of the SaaS company that focuses on construction software management?
Absolutely. The way I look at customer support, at least our role specifically, is if there is any question a customer has, more than likely, I'd say 99% of the time, support's going to be able to either provide the answer or find the answer for that customer. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we can't work with other teams or and gain other resources, but support's kind of one of the many teams of Procore, or one of the few teams, I should say, of Procore, that's kind of leaned on to know everything about the product itself, mm-hmm. right? So, and we have the product knowledge because we are constantly interfacing with customers on a consistent basis and answering as many questions as possible. So if I was to whittle it down to its essence, it essentially is any questions that they're going to have about the product lines and about the platform itself, we're going to be able to help with that and help resolve those issues.
Geek Squad for
essentially, yeah.
Company.
Yeah, essentially.
I love it. And what does a typical day look like for support, and how do you get all that training? Because coming from the CSM side, and I feel like we have to know so much. I always have so much empathy for support. So I feel like they're on another level of Procore that I'm not even on. So how do you even gain all that knowledge? Do you guys have a lot of training, or what does that look like?
So, I mean, we have a standard training. We start off with orientation, and then we have onboarding. You're onboarding for about 90 days, and then you're put into either your queue where you're going to be chat specific or phone specific. I was actually moved over very, very recently to a flex team, which we're case specific. So we do all of the emails essentially. So email certifications, importing, we kind of handle those queues. But a lot of the training that we get is going to be on the job training, because so much of Procore is going to be kind of theory based, as far as like this thing could happen or this thing could happen or this is what usually happens. But so much more experience you get is by actually doing it. So those first 90 days, you're kind of getting all of the basics and all of the groundwork and all of the basic information to get you started. But so much of training is just coming from trial and error and getting those questions that you can't answer and asking your supervisor, your team leads or tech coaches, and kind of giving that knowledge. So I would say 70% of it is things that you're going to learn on the job, and you're going to learn as you're doing, for sure.
Dang. So it sounds like you need to be adaptable.
Absolutely. Like that's, I think that's a huge skill of being in customer support. If you're not adaptable, it's going to be rough for you.
And so since you both are actually in this space, I'll pose a question to both of you. But you know, the idea of a good customer support team, at a software company, I mean, like, what are the advantages of focusing, you know, good resources into that space? Like, what would that do for the company? And what would it look like if a company had bad customer support? What are the other parts of the org that would be affected? Sure. Yeah.
I think that a lot of times customer support is the face of the company, right? So if you are, at least for our company itself, if you're a specialty contractor or you're someone who's on a team of a GC and you never met a CSM or implementation manager or a sales or install base, like, you have no idea who these people are. Mm-hmm. So anytime you're going to have an issue or a concern, or even if you just want to kind of get a better understanding of something, you're going to contact support. So essentially, I think that in a nutshell, we can be the face of the company. And there are pros and cons to that, right? I think one of the huge benefits is if we do our job and do our job effectively and we do our job right, That's going to bring more return business for the company. It's going to bring better CSAT scores for us as a team. And it's ultimately going to, I would like to think, make everyone else's job easier. If there are questions that we can answer, that there are things that the client might not have to go to their Procore point of contact to kind of get resolved. But I think there are some cons to that because there are things that we may not have access to. We're not coders, we're not developers. So when someone calls in and says, hey, I need this thing done now, it's like, well, I would love to tell you that we can do that, but because we are that first line of defense or that first, you know, intro into the company, there are things that we, you know, we just can't do. We don't have access to. So there are ups and downs to it for sure.
Totally. Do you find yourself having to reset expectations a lot in support?
You mean like for the customer when they call in or? I think so. I think every single opportunity is a learning opportunity for the customer and for us. I think every single time that we interact with someone, we understand that there are no two clients who are exactly the same. So we have to kind of reset. But I think also for them, it is resetting expectations and saying, hey, we're going to try to get this thing resolved for you. And this is the way we go about doing it. So absolutely.
That pre-recorded message, your call may be recorded for training purposes. Is that real? Is that like what's going on there?
I'm going to be honest with you. I've only done calls one time or two times.
Yeah.
So I've never said that. That's not a prompt that we have. And I'm not even sure if the service says that. I do know that managers can listen into calls.
Okay.
So they can listen to them while they're active. So they can listen to them after the fact as well. So, but I'm not sure if that prompt is that prompt?
Is that part like of a training at all though? Like, do you guys look at past user cases?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So let me backtrack for a second. So yes, we can record conversations and managers do use that for training opportunities because they'll say, hey, you know, on this call that you had 2 weeks ago, this was said, but it's also used to kind of help us out too, right? Where you may have a customer who gives you a low score and we try to figure out why it happened and we can kind of go back to the call and say, okay, the customer was being reckless or, you know, what they're saying is not accurate. So
it's so funny because, you know, whenever you're going to deal with a customer, I would, and again, this is me speaking ignorantly, but I would assume the majority aren't happy. They're having to reach out or the majority aren't going to be. So, I mean, that in it is a skill. I mean, what are some of the things you've learned about yourself dealing with? Because you know your history, you've worked at, you know, Optivo before this and FedEx and in these areas in which you're dealing essentially with a lot of the customers, right?
Sure.
You're not dealing with the people that are very happy with the product.
Yeah. I like to think that most problems are fixable.
Right.
So and they're usually is a solution. It may not be the solution that they want, or the solution that they necessarily are looking to hear, but every single problem has a solution. The toughest things we kind of come up against is payments, because when you kind of exchange money, it's hard to say this money went here, let me get that money back, right? But everything pretty much in the platform has a solution for it. So it's important to identify that when you're talking to someone and saying, hey, let's move this conversation forward productively, right? And let's try to get to whatever the root cause is, so we make sure we don't have that ever again. And let's try to get to a point where I can train you via this chat or this call so that you don't have to call in again if this thing does happen again in the future. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my background has taught me that is as long as you're searching for the answer, you're searching for that solution, there's a way to find it and there's also a way to present it. I've had customers call in or chat in who are like angry, furious. This thing isn't working. Why isn't Procore doing this? Why isn't your system doing this? Yeah. And they're just frustrated, right? It's hard to be on site and something's not working properly, but it's just important to say, hey, listen, let's work on this together. Let's get a solution. Let's try to make sure we move forward productively and I'm going to get this all for you. Yeah.
Are most of the time, are they coming in hot and heavy, would you say? Or is it,
no,
I'm sure it's a toss-up?
Yeah, it's kind of a toss-up. I mean, you know, obviously from chats and emails, it's hard to kind of get the inflection of how they're coming in. I think phone calls are a little bit different because you're talking to a live person. You know, it's a lot of times, I won't say they're angry or they're mad, but they're rushed. because so many people are like, hey, I need this thing done now. This thing isn't working for me. I need it done now. Why isn't it working now? So it's that level of immediacy that we have to kind of temper. So I don't think they're really angry. It's just more or less like hurried and trying to manage, how do I make it so that you're not on the chat for an hour, but how do we really get to the issue of what's going on and try to resolve it? So.
Absolutely. And would you say too, with all your backgrounds in customer support, would you say like that hurriedness is specific to construction because they're out on the job site and they're trying to get stuff done and
it's consistent across the board. Everyone wants everything now. I mean, I've worked at Enterprise Rent-A-Car and people want cars now, right? I worked at FedEx and printing, people want prints now. Like no one's waiting for anything and everyone is always more important than the person behind them in line. So I think it's kind of a consistent across the board thing of everyone, you know, I think it's just a generational thing. It's just like the idea of immediacy and wanting things now when you want it. And so it's just important to kind of understand that going into it. And I think my experience has helped me kind of understand and process that. And so it doesn't really faze me at all.
Would you say that you've gained more empathy or certain skills from customer success in dealing kind of with like setting out these fires or getting to the root cause?
Absolutely. I definitely believe that my time in support across many companies has given me a lot more empathy, and especially being a customer myself. I approach things differently now as a customer because I have gained the empathy. Back before COVID happened, if we go to a restaurant, there's like a long wait. I'm a lot more patient and understanding of these situations, being on the phone for different providers and just understanding what that process is like, because we don't always know what's going on behind the scenes. We don't know what it looks like to answer what we would think is a simple question, you know, so it's definitely given me a lot more empathy.
So you would say that the superhero quality of someone in your positions would be the power of empathy.
Absolutely. I think the power of empathy and understanding is paramount for sure. Like it's some of the more valuable skills. I think as long as you have empathy, it's going to be able to help you out through so many more things. You're not even going to realize it. Mm.
And, you know, you've had a long history in this space. I know that, Tyler on the call has been in that role and he's moved on to other things. And Michaela, you're jumping into this space now as well. Does it take a certain type of person to be successful in longevity filled in this space? Or do you think this is a role where like anybody can step in and be successful at this?
I do think anyone can step into the role and be successful. I don't think support takes a very specific person. I do think that there are a couple of traits that I identify as a support rep that I think are important. Obviously we talked about empathy. I think patience is a big part of it. And I think ultimately your ability and desire to learn, because any position you're going to get in, I mean, there are definitely some jobs that people have where their day is very much so the same. It's the monotony that you're trying to break because every day is just very, very mundane. Support's not like that. It's very, very possible you can get asked the same question 2 days in a row, but out of the 20 or so odd cases that you're going to take, every single situation is going to be different. And it's going to cause for you to kind of go back into your toolbox or your bag of tricks and figure out, okay, how do we answer this thing? How do we answer this thing? And it definitely teaches you to kind of put away these answers to questions so that you can use them for the future. So I believe that anyone can do it, but there are definitely traits that can be identified to say this person can be very successful as long as they have these things.
Okay. And now let's get into a little bit more of your life now. Sure. How do you stumble upon the customer support world? Because I see you went to college, got a degree for mass communications. I went to business college and I never really spent much more than maybe a class on customer support, right?
Sure.
I started out in recruiting, and that's one area where a lot of people often just kind of stumble into postgraduate. So how does one get into customer support?
It was a job and they were hiring, basically. Exactly, I don't think customer support is a role that anyone's, and I'll speak for myself. It was never a role that I was like looking for, and I wanted to pursue a career in customer support. For me, you know, I've been fortunate enough to basically every company I worked for, I've gone in as a support rep or just kind of an entry level and worked my way up to management. Mm. I enjoy the management role. I enjoy managing individuals. I enjoy kind of coordinating and leading a team to an ultimate goal. So again, it wasn't something where I said I wanted to go into being a support rep and kind of sustaining that lifestyle. It's always been, all right, I don't know anything about this field. I don't know anything about renting cars. I worked at, you know, Enterprise. I didn't know anything about printing products. And there's a lot to know about printing products at FedEx. Right. But it was important to go in as an entry level and then, you know, kind of work your way up and do something different. So, but yeah.
What about the process, or where does that diligence come from, the ability to be patient and work through the steps that it takes to get to the place where you want to be? Because I know a lot of people, like you talked about our generation, and
sure,
you know, a lot of people kind of want that instant gratification and kind of miss the entire journey.
Yeah.
That's important to go through.
For me, I think it's a matter of understanding that there is, so every single company I work for and every job I've gone into, if they don't have one already, I try to develop my own individual development plan. What is this like for me for 6 months, 9 months, and a year? And that's kind of what I've gotten from my management training, but I try to approach every single position as that. I look at it from the immediate benefits, whether that is, this is going to be a paycheck, or this is going to be great benefits, or this is going to be a great company I'm going to work for. And I look at it for, what are the long-term benefits? I can honestly say I've never gone into a company knowing I want to quit or knowing I want to leave, right? I don't start a company saying, in 3 years time, I'm going to be out of here, right? So it's never like, all right, cool. 6 months, I'm out, I'm gone. But I think ultimately you can go into a situation and look for some kind of ultimate career path, and it may not work out for you that way. So for me, the perseverance comes from, okay, what do I see? Where do I see myself? Do I see myself in this role? Do I see myself in another role? And how do I get there? And then kind of start the process of getting to this other place. And so for me, it took a while to identify what that is at Procore, and I found it. So now it's just a matter of going on that path to get to where I want to be. But that it's all about the planning for me. It's all about the ultimate journey.
I love the fact that you like break it down, like you have this end goal and then you break it back down. I think that's so valuable, especially for our listeners. Cause I know like my friends and I have a joke, like we're always looking on LinkedIn and it's like, oh, this job requires 10 plus years of experience and whatnot. And I feel like that's very common for our generation.
Absolutely.
And so it's refreshing to hear people be like, hey, you don't need to start there. Like just start somewhere and build up to it.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I've learned too is, in many cases, at least in my experience, companies want to hire from within. An external employee or external hire, even if they have a great amount of experience, just kind of comes with like a lot of learning curves. Mm-hmm. And so if you can get in an entry-level position, that thing that they said they want 10 years for, you may be able to learn that skill in 6 months. And there's very, very possible they can say, hey, we have, you know, we have Chris, let's just go in and hire this guy for this position. So I never want to kind of discount or discredit the idea of starting from somewhere entry, not lower, and kind of working my way up from there, because there are some definite benefits to it.
So you don't seem, I'm just going to be presumptuous here, you don't seem like you quit a lot of things. You seem like you like to see things through, but I'm going to assume that you have. So what do you tell yourself when it's time to cut something off or let it go?
What's it costing me? And I don't mean just like financially. I mean, what is it costing me emotionally? What is it costing me physically? What is it? Is there a cost benefit to it? And I do it for everything. And that goes for, you know, jobs or projects I've worked on or companies, careers. It's just, what is the ultimate benefit to continue to persevere? And, you know, I think I've gotten really, really good at being honest with myself and saying, this is not going to end in a positive way. And I think it's time to kind of cut ties with it. And it's a very, very difficult decision to come to. Cause like you said, I don't like quitting things. I want to try as hard as I can to make sure this is perfect.
Right.
And that it is what it's supposed to be, but it's a matter of, you know, am I losing my hair? Right. Or am I losing, time with my family? Am I losing time with, you know, whatever that looks like outside of work or whatever the situation is, what's that cost? And if the cost doesn't, if it's not worth it, I'll leave it alone. Mm.
I love that. I have trouble. I'm kind of the same way. I don't quit a lot of things. And I feel like that's just from my upbringing. But I think there's something valuable in knowing when to quit. And so I'm curious from your perspective, like when for you does it come time where you're like, okay, I need to reevaluate. Like this is something that I need to sit down and maybe I do a SWOT analysis or I just walk outside and think about it.
Things don't come easy to me. I like to say that I pick up on things pretty quickly. And I don't think there's a lot of things I start thinking I'm going to quit or there's a petition I'm going to quit, right? So I'm trying to think of a good example, but I think there's a natural point. There's a natural point where there hasn't been a lot of progression and it's not really going into a positive direction. And I can kind of make that distinction of when it is. And it's not to say it's 6 months or 9 months or whatever that looks like. I've had, films I've started writing and I'm like, okay, this script isn't going the direction I want to go. So I'll stop writing it and come back to it. Or I've had things that, kind of go into production and don't really pan out, had jobs, that kind of thing. But I don't think there's a finite time where I say, okay, this is happening. It's just kind of a feeling I get where I'm like, okay, this is not going well.
Yeah, we gotta go.
Yeah, Chris is great at this because he's like just leading me into the next topics like as we go along. So
totally.
fun size riot films.
Yes.
That is the question.
That is the question.
You take the answer any way you want.
It's a film company I started in. Technically, I started in California about 10 years ago, and then officially started it here in Austin like about 8 years ago now. And it's a company that produces web-based content, short and feature films. We've done a couple of projects in recent years. We haven't really done anything this year. We released a web series this year. I say we, but it's mainly me and the company. Right. But it's fun, man. I enjoy filmmaking. I've been doing it for a while now. And the company is just a way to have my stamp on anything that I produce and come out with and work on.
Okay. So
what kind of stuff do you like to produce and work on?
Thank you.
It varies. So for me, I think I've always kind of leaned into dramas. I like dramas. I like the potential for actors to act in dramas because I do think it gives them a little bit more meatier roles. I enjoy writing dramas. I enjoy writing dialogue. But we're trying to get into horror filmmaking. It's just kind of different genres. But for me, it's always been dramas or dramedies or just kind of a hint of comedy in there. But we haven't really skewed into like action or horror or any of that kind of stuff. But the web series we just did that we released in April of this year was a dramedy. So.
Ooh, dramedy. That's fun.
Drama and comedy, I feel like, are the same thing, right?
That's my favorite, man.
They all derive from the same place. So where along the lines between during your professional career, your corporate career, I'll say,
sure.
And the art career, when do these two, where do these two intersect?
Rarely, if at all. A lot of times where they'll kind of intersect is I'll have to do some editing for a company, or I'll have to do, I won't say they correlate specifically, but I think what film has helped me with is like pitching an idea. Mm-hmm. And that kind of comes into play. Being able to read people, right? So when you have someone read a script or you have someone kind of hear an idea of yours, being able to gauge their interaction has helped me in the workplace because that's helped me to understand I'm saying this thing to somebody and I'm watching how they're reacting. And even if it's something as innocent as a conversation, that filmmaking background has given me insight into how to read that. Because it's very different asking someone for $20,000 to do a movie versus asking someone if they want to like go to dinner. But you start to pick up on the idea of they're very similar body languages to people when they're having a negative reaction to what you're asking or a positive reaction. So I definitely think the filmmaking and that process of pitching and meetings has helped me in my everyday life.
And you talked about the short, mid, and long-term visions for the corporate side.
Sure.
What does that look like for fun size riot films?
I don't want to say I've let the dream go because I still enjoy filmmaking. Right now, it's more of a hobby than it is a business. Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, I would love for someone to pay me a substantial amount of money to go make one of my productions. But for me, it is now and always has been a great creative outlet. And it's something I have sole control over, something I can do whenever I want to, that doesn't dictate the rest of my life, but I'm able to dictate it. And I'm able to make stories that connect with people and that I enjoy doing. So the ultimate goal for the film company is just to continue creating content that more people find out about, more people enjoy. And wherever that takes me, it takes me. But I don't have like a finite, I'm going to direct, you know, Iron Man 4 in the next 2 years. Like, it's not like that.
Was there like an affirmation that you received that helped you along that path? Because the reason why I'm asking that is in my personal journey, you know, I started doing comedy, and that's just one of many entertainment outlets that I would enjoy doing. But that was pretty much the first time that I like believed in myself doing something that's kind of off the beaten path. And I toyed around with my self-confidence a lot. And you know, thinking it was a dumb idea. And I remember the moment at which, if you know, that validation of, no, this is not stupid, you know, keep on going down this path, and it kind of kept going. For you, was there a moment, or was there a project that you worked on that helped you realize that this is actually something that I can go down and create a film company?
I mean, I don't think there was a specific moment. I remember being in college and creating what I know now are crappy films, horrific films. That if I ever showed them to anybody, like, they were just really, really bad. They were really bad.
Bad from what perspective, though? Like, the acting is cheesy, or the editing is bad?
I was all bad. I mean, it was all, like, from A to Z, it was all bad. But I remember being in school, and, you know, because I'm a big idea guy. So I remember being in school and filming the movie and editing it and doing everything I do now. And then, like, I would create these premieres, right? So, and I worked at the student union, so it was easy for me to, like, rent a room or rent our theater room, and I would charge people admission to come to these movies. Now, mind you, I'm charging people like $1 a ticket, right? To come to this movie I produced for like $50. So I'm making my profit back, but I thought I was like hot stuff, right? And so I was like, oh yeah, I can do this, right? People, my friends are coming to see this thing. I'm selling out, you know, this theater. Yeah. These are horrible movies. They're traffic jams. So,
oh my gosh, that's so much guts though to put
yourself out there. Oh man, I don't know where it came from. I want to go back and talk to that guy, you know, now, because now I'm so protective of the work, where it's like, oh no, it's not ready yet. No, it's not ready yet. Now I'll show you, you know, that kind of thing. And so to kind of go from doing this movie where I can let anyone see it and charge money for it to, hey, I don't even know if I want to send this to a festival, took a long time. It's a long journey, but I can't pinpoint any one thing where I say that's what made me realize it wasn't a foolish goal. But if I had to, it would be that time of saying, of reflecting back on that time and saying, at one point, I was making crappy movies with crappy equipment and charging people money to come see this, and people were genuinely enjoying it. And I was like making, you know, burnt DVDs out of my apartment, and people were buying them, right? And I'm pretty like, there are countless DVDs of these old movies that are out there, and I'm just waiting for, you know, me to get some fame from this and get some fortune, and then those DVDs resurface, and I have to answer those questions, right? but I know, but I think at that time it was, hey, I can do this thing. People are enjoying it, and I'm only going to get better from here. And so I can obviously reflect now 10 years ago, or, you know, 15 years ago, like, oh, that was really, really bad. But I know that's what started me on this journey. And so I know that kind of is an affirmation to me that we're only going to get better. And I feel like at the end of the day, as long as you're doing your art for you, that's what's most important. Whatever that creative outlet is for you, that's what it is. It is a creative outlet. So if you spend so much time or so much credence into whether or not someone's going to like your work, you're going to get into the cycle of, man, am I doing good enough for someone else, as opposed to, what am I enjoying? How am I liking it? Am I having fun with it? And that thing, that's the most important thing. Because at the end of the day, if you're not, then it doesn't matter. You're just doing it for other people, and you're losing the kind of the idea of doing the creative art for yourself.
Totally. How beautiful. Too. I feel like I live with an artist, and so he actually produces music videos, and so that's what he does. And I feel like it's kind of the same journey of like, this is so crappy, I'll show it to you, and then like, no, don't look at it. And I'm like, wait, this is beautiful, show the world. Nah. Like, But how do you think that evolution comes? Because I've been trying to like study and figure this out from him from like a third person perspective. But it's like, are you just getting so much better that like your bar for yourself is so much higher? So you want to keep it, you know, intact?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think creatives, and I don't want to say artists, but I think creative individuals are, unless you're in a field like comedy, right? Like stand-up mm-hmm. comedy, where you have to kind of present your art to the world to get better, because that's kind of how you engage how your jokes are landing and how they're hitting. With filmmaking, I want to say it's even more subjective, because what I can think is a masterpiece, someone might think is like toilet paper, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think as a creative, we are a little more protective, because we don't want this thing that we're so close to and so personal with, for there to be an opportunity for someone to say they don't like it, right? And we don't want to be so vain to say, I want everyone to like every single thing that I do. But there is this expectation to say, I do want a few people to say it's good, right? And it definitely is a process. I won't even say it's a journey, but it's definitely a process to say, I'm getting better as a creative, I'm getting better as a filmmaker, or whatever that looks like. And I know that I'm getting better because I'm producing better content, but I'm also getting better at this process of getting feedback and constructive criticism from other individuals and being okay with that. I just got to that point.
Is there a movie out there that it offends you that people don't like it more?
Ooh. I don't think so. A movie that it offends me that people, there's probably movies that offend me that people like as much as they do, but I don't think there's anything where I wish like people like more. I mean, there are movies that I enjoy, I don't think enough people know about.
Yeah.
But there's not anything I can think of that like offends me because people don't enjoy it as much.
Right. All right. Let's hear the other one then. What's the movies that you? That
oh you man, do? You're getting me to dangerous territory now, man. it's a lot, man. There are movies. I'll put it this way. I think that there are movies that are very, very popular in pop culture that I don't think objectively are as good as people think they are, and I'll leave it at that.
They're like overhyped.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think from a pop culture perspective, it's easy to get kind of bought into the hyperbole of like how good something is mm-hmm. based upon how it's sustained in pop culture. But when we start looking at things again objectively, it's like, yeah, that wasn't that good.
And so, Chris, you have this job that takes a lot of, well, I would think takes a bunch of mental real estate. Am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Mental energy, I'll say, right? And then you
For sure.
have this side hobby, which you said has kind of taken taken a backseat to the professional career, but you are still working on side projects.
Absolutely.
Where do you find the time, or what do you do to find the time, I'll say, to execute on all these things? Because I this is the time to have a side hobby, right? We're all quarantined here and together, and it's more important than ever, or else people are just literally going to work 20 hours a day and then go to sleep. So how do you do it?
Realistically, I don't sleep. So that's the honest to God truth. I don't sleep very often. I'll sleep, you know, a few hours a night. And I think primarily some of that is, and I mean, again, there are times where I do get sleep, but when I'm working on multiple things at the same time, I don't sleep that often. And I'm okay with that, right? Like that's not, I don't want anybody's sympathy, but it's one of those things where I'm like, I can operate off less sleep because I'm moving toward a goal. And once those goals are done, I can start getting back to my 8 hours of sleep or whatever, right? So the work is consistent. That doesn't change. So I know every single day I have to put in this amount of energy to work. But then outside of that, there are projects, whether it be film or, you know, my own personal podcast. I say, okay, this is going to require this much time, this much energy to go into it. Let me go ahead and knock off these amount of hours I would normally sleep and complete that project. Then once that's done in a week or so, I can catch up on sleep and sleep for, you know, however long I need to. But in all honesty, I just don't sleep as often as I probably should. It's a sacrifice I make because, you know, for me, it's a matter of, you know, I don't live by myself, right? So I'm married. So I want to make sure that I give time to my job, to my passion, to my wife, to my dog, to cleaning up around the house. Like, so that, you know, you kind of have to compartmentalize everything. And one of the things that kind of takes a little backseat is sleep sometimes. So,
I mean, man, I can 100% empathize. Unfortunately, my creative apex is like between 11:30 and 2 a.m.
Yeah,
11:30 exactly. And 2 a.m. And the thought of sleep is like, it feels like guilty almost, like you're selling yourself short. Like I have, I'm never going to be like this creative again in this moment. I'm sleep. Okay. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah.
I'm kind of curious, Chris, too. How do you, with all your jobs, like you mentioned podcast, you have your own filming, you have Procore. How do you balance also, I feel like going from this technical space to this creative space? Like, do you have to find time to like get yourself back in this creative element?
Yes, because you're going from doing something, like you said, very, very technical on a consistent basis where your brain kind of needs a break. And so for me, I will usually watch, or I'll cook. So I enjoy cooking. So I usually will cook after work and that gives me enough of a break. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll like watch some short TV show or just the kind of something to give myself a little bit of a time off. And then once that's done, I'll hop into the creative and that'll take me through however long I'm doing that. And then I'll be able to go to sleep and kind of get ready for work the next day. So I try to cook to kind of break up that idea of me using so much of my brain and then me using so much of my brain. There's that, that window there. I like to get in the kitchen and do something.
Totally. Cause I feel like as we're all like just stuck at home, that can be kind of hard to divide that time and divide those spaces. Like I know for me, I need to get out and like feel the sun to be more creative and get in my element.
Yeah, that was tough for me early on. When we first got in quarantine, I was finishing up editing a web series and I was at my desk for work on chats nonstop. And then I would get off the chats and then go straight into editing. There was no going to cook or doing because I was trying to meet a deadline. Mm-hmm. And so once that was done, I was able to say, okay, I'm not doing anything else film related or I'm taking a break from it for a while because it was literally, I was at the same desk for over almost 15 hours a day. So between working and going straight into editing. So that was very, very tough. And that kind of broke me toward the beginning of quarantine, but now it's a lot better. That's a lot better. I have a few more spaces to go to.
Let's jump a little bit further back into how you even found your passion.
I don't want to give the cliched answer of I saw Jurassic Park in 1993 and that spawned my desire to be a filmmaker. For me, it's very, very simple. When I was growing up, every single Friday, from I want to say the time I was in first and second grade until the time I graduated from middle school into high school, my mom, my brother, and I would always go to Blockbuster Video and rent three movies and we would get pizza. And like, that was our weekend, right? Like that was how we started the weekend. So I knew after school on Friday, I would get to go to Blockbuster. And, you know, as you get older, you go from like the kids section to like you can start going into the regular section, right, to start picking out different movies. And so for me, it was always this fascination with film and how films. And so it was always an idea of, oh, this is cool. I get to watch movies. I get to watch movies as much as I want. I get to watch this movie 1,000 times. And I didn't know it as a kid, but I was destroying my mom, right? Like our sanity, right? And I think the older I got, it was less about, oh, I get to watch movies. And it was, how was this movie made? How do they do that? How do you make a movie where someone jumps off of a bridge and they just are unscathed? How do you have dinosaurs in movies? How do you do these things? And so that really brought me into the idea of the how. And I think that's what allowed me to tap into my passion, because I like to know how things work, not everything. I don't really care how a car works or how a cell phone works, I'm gonna be honest with you. But there are other things that, like for filmmaking specifically, it was something that I liked. I wanted to know how it worked and I knew I could do it. If you ask me to put an engine back together, it's a fail. But you ask me to write a movie, I got you.
Yeah, I just watched Jurassic Park yesterday and that movie is greatly underappreciated.
It's impressive how it stands up over time. Yeah. impressive.
Yeah. And then I remember making my mom take me to go see Rush Hour in the movie theater. So she's dishing out $10 a time for me to repeat every line.
Yep.
So Were there role models that you had, or was it like, you know, anywhere from producers to writers to actors, or?
I don't think there was any one director or writer or anything that stood out. Cause back then I didn't really care about, you know, the names of people who wrote movies or who directed movies. It was, you know, I think there are names that are always thrown around. Spielberg is a huge name that was thrown around when I was younger, but I don't want to say like Spielberg inspired me to be a filmmaker. It was just like, right. He made some cool movies and I can't even remember like actors that I used to idolize. And, you know, I had a conversation recently. It was like, who's your favorite actor? I was like, I don't have one. Right. I like roles that people have been in. I like I don't have a favorite director. There are films that directors have made that I enjoy, but I don't have like one favorite that stands out to me. Right.
But the answer would be Denzel Washington though.
What's that?
The answer would be Denzel Washington.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't think there was any one particular role model for me. I was just fascinated. I think I will say that when I was younger, more so than now, because I understand what goes into it, I was more attracted to action films. Mm-hmm. So action films, blockbusters, things that were like huge and fantastical. You put me in another world, I'm all for it.
Right.
I was never like a huge fan of horror movies and dramas when I was younger. It just didn't do anything for me.
Right.
But you blow something up, I'm on board for sure.
Oh man, well, we are getting close to the end here.
Sure.
Michaela, do you want to wrap this up with a very cheesy ending like we like to do here?
Yeah, our favorite cheesy question. If you could go back and give Chris any piece of advice, what would you tell Chris today?
Young Chris.
Young Chris to old Chris.
There's a, I would tell young Chris that in his first year of college, there's going to be two companies he should invest in.
I knew you were going to say this.
And those two companies are Facebook and YouTube. And as long as you put your money in them, you'll be really, really good. in a serious note, I think that...
That can be serious.
Yeah, I was serious. I didn't learn until later on that to make each moment count. Right. And to make sure you preserve moments like that's very, very important to me now. I'm able to identify certain aspects of my life that were important that I didn't appreciate enough back then. Mm-hmm. And so it would be just making sure you're identifying certain moments, taking a moment for yourself and really living in those moments and remembering them for when you get older.
That's beautiful. Thanks so much for sharing that.
Yeah.
What is, you got to plug yourself, man. What's your podcast that we're going to be listening to?
Listen, man, the podcast actually doesn't have a name right now. It's a no-name podcast.
What
we did is we started recording episodes. So right now we're about 8 episodes deep. We're going to record 2 more and then we're going to start releasing because there'll be like 1 a week. But yeah, the podcast is coming out soon. I have a web series on YouTube right now called Best of the Worst Days. You can go find on YouTube and Vimeo. I think it's 8 episodes, something like that. And yeah, that's what I got so far.
So, Chris, man, thank you so
love
much.
Love it.
For your time. Thank you for being open.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your story.
Yeah,
I love it. Thanks for having me.
Just seeing more stuff that you put out, man. I'm on board now. I'm a fan.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
We're on the Chris train, baby.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.